Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
This is The Word Podcast. Special guest, Rodri Marsden. Rodri, welcome.
Hello.
Rodri, who wrote a much applauded piece in Word a couple of months ago about 40 noises that shaped pop music. Two-part piece, which we're going to be talking about in detail and maybe even moving towards a third part of this. But first of all, Rodri, we always ask people who come on The Word Podcast, what music was in your house when you were growing up as a child? What was there? Were there any records and so forth?
There were. My father was a massive Buddy Holly fan, and still is. And every Sunday evening, the record player would come out and he would play old 45s, most of which were Buddy Holly. So, Buddy Holly predominantly. And the Wombles were like a huge thing for me when I was four.
Right.
If that even counts. And I still think Mike Batt back then was just an incredible pop genius.
It's interesting, there's a piece, interview with Chris Spedding in the current issue of Word, where he's talking about Chris Spedding's work with absolutely everybody, from kind of Jack Bruce, Brian Ferry, whatever. And of course, he was a Womble.
I didn't know that.
And you can tell which one's Chris, because they appeared at Glastonbury not long ago, because he always plays the Flying V.
Right.
Outside the Womble suit. But he says that about Mike Batt, that of all the people he's worked with, Mike Batt's one of the most remarkable, because he could do absolutely anything in a studio.
Yeah, it's weird. Since then, Mike Batt actually follows me on Twitter, and we occasionally exchange things. I'm quite disappointed with his Twitter output compared to his music. I did post a clip I had of me singing along with a Wombles song when I was four. I had a cassette, and I posted that, singing along to Wombling Merry Christmas, and he did reply saying how great he thought that was, and that his own son did the same thing. So we have an emotional bond now.
Good,
but maybe we've talked too much about the
Wombles. So nowadays you're a writer and a musician. How does that work?
The writing makes me the money, and the music spends the money.
Right. Okay. So you play music with who?
Most notably with Green Gartside in Scritability. Although activity is sporadic, as is traditional with the great man. And I do lots of other little bits and pieces, including playing in a TV theme tune tribute band called Dream Themes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How does that work? Oh, tell us about that.
Well, we used to be Frank Sidebottom's backing band. Whenever he did gigs in the south of England, we would be his backing, the Oh Blimey Big Band. And when Frank was doing the raffle, his gigs, we used to play TV theme tunes, Grandstand or Terry and June, as I remember. And
how's the Terry and June theme go? It does indeed, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That takes me right back.
Yeah. So we just went with that, and so we play remarkably inept, very loud versions of TV theme tunes.
But it's popular. There's an audience for something like that, isn't it?
Not particularly, but I mean, we don't have a following. But it's quite nice to turn up and do a gig, and for everyone to know all the songs.
Yes, yes.
and for them to be cheered when you finish them, which is kind of quite unusual for me.
Yeah.
So although it is strange because most of the people in the band are in their mid to late 30s. So we have a certain affection for things like, Screen Test or the A-Team, a very particular era. And then you play in a room to a bunch of 20-somethings who are just thinking, why are these men playing these instrumentals?
I don't know.
It's exactly. Just
completely identified with one particular generation, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's quite hard to come up with TV theme tunes, current TV theme tunes that we want to do. So anyway, I won't drag you into our own personal hell on that.
So to talk about the this piece that we ran in Word in two parts, 40 noises that made pop music. Now, when you were first presented with this as an idea, What did you think? What were the big challenges in terms of putting together a list of things? So did you think, yes, immediately that'll work or not?
I think the first problem is thinking of any, in a way, because a lot of these sounds you just take for granted, and you don't think of songs in terms of these building blocks. Really, you think about, I don't know, the emotion it provokes or what have you. So it was initially a struggle to come up with them, and then I kind of cast around a bit and asked people, and then you almost get into the mind space, and they started pouring forth, and I think I ended up with far too many. I had to start hacking back brutally.
So which are your favourites of the one? Just give an idea of anybody who hasn't read this or seen this. Well, a few of your favourites of the kind of things that we've got on these lists.
I think the first one on the list was the piano glissando, which we all hear
which
now.
Which phrase is going to play? That's it. That's the glissando. So, known to laymen as just running your hand...
Yeah,
I'm down the keyboard.
Yeah, I mean, I learned piano from the age of six, so I have a kind of affection with that kind of, with the piano full stop. But I think when I was younger, that represented something quite thrilling in the realm. You know, when you're sitting playing Bach preludes every morning for several years, the idea of
just going for it.
that kind of. Virtuoso flash.
And presumably that's on nearly all of Jerry Lee Lewis's records.
One would imagine so. I think if he delivered a recording that didn't include it, it would probably be sent back to him.
But yeah, so that became a signature. So what else have we got?
This is kind of piano thing now, but my favourite sound ever, I think, is the Fender Rhodes.
And that's that keyboard that we're hearing in a second.
And here it's his, yeah.
That's Steely Dan.
Yeah.
Babylon Sisters, is that what it is?
It is.
The tune. So that's one particular... That's a case of a sound coming from one particular instrument, not on the way it's played or anything like that. Tell us about the Fender Rhodes.
I didn't know this until I wrote the piece, but apparently it was... the Fender Rhodes was designed as a keyboard to be used by servicemen in hospital. Because it could kind of sit on their beds and they could play, which seems extraordinary. And when I've repeated it to people, they've just said, "No, you're kidding," but apparently it's true. But I'm quite interested in this whole group of sounds that was in this piece, which emerged from technology companies attempting to emulate the piano during the 50s and 60s and 70s, and trying to emulate the piano in a portable form, and failing horribly, but coming up with something very beautiful as a result. And the clavinet is another example of that.
What's the clavinet sound like? Have we got that? Have we got an example of a clavinet?
Well, Stevie Wonder is the kind of predominant exponent. There it is.
Is that a clavinet?
Yeah, pushed through a wah-wah pedal.
So it's the idea that in the 50s and 60s, every sophisticated house wanted to have a piano, but they didn't have a room for a piano, or it was regarded as a piece of furniture that everybody wanted.
Yeah.
And so that if the companies could come up with something that was a more easily managed alternative, they'd go for it.
And, of course, today you have a piano in a tiny box that big, and you just plug a MIDI cable into it, and... So that problem has now gone away.
Right.
But, it created some beautiful, beautiful sounds, I think. I mean, the Rhodes has several kinds of sound, from the tinkly, very tinkly sound that I kind of associate with 80s pop music, to that more mellifluous noise that Donald Fagen made there.
So give us another example. What else have we got?
I quite like the explosive James Brown grunt.
This is I think referred to as ugh, spelled EUGH. Is that right? Exclamation mark.
Yeah.
We've got an example, Fraser. So that's got a bit of an H sound in it as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think he sometimes dispensed with the H, and just went with the.
Right.
That was rubbish. That was terrible. And that's why. I'm not famous for making the noise, and James Brown is.
So that sound became a key part of loads of James Brown records. People just expected that sound to be there.
Yeah, I quite like it. I quite like it as a just as a musical exclamation mark. Do you know what I mean? Rounding off phrases in that way. And now I've lost my way.
No, all right, don't worry. We can fix that. Now, your selection of sounds here, is there anything that these sounds have in common? I wonder if, to some extent, they're kind of like the musical equivalent of fast food, you know what I mean? that there's something that just appeals to the public ear. You know, when they hear it, they just think, you know, you go back to Jerry Lee Lewis and the fingernail down the keyboard and, you know, there's just something about it that people think, it's beyond music. It's kind of play.
Mm. I mean, one interesting thing I found in this was the way that virtuosity is either applauded or not applauded. One example in the piece was the kind of tapping on the fingerboard, the very fast guitar solo.
Right. Now this, I think this is that's Eddie Van Halen, is it?
Listen to him go.
So what are you saying? People approve of that?
Well,
or not?
I think there's something to do with guitarists cramming in as many notes per second as they can is somehow seen as almost heroic. But any display of virtuosity from bass players seems to have scorn poured upon it. So I mean, we had slap bass in there, and we had fretless bass in there.
So that's slap bass.
This is slap Stanley Clark Lopsy Loo, which is a fantastic thing, I think.
So what happens when a sound like that kind of arrives in music, you know, and Stanley Clark is a, you know, very exceptional bass player and so forth. Do loads of musicians hear it and think, I want to do that. I want to make that. I want to put that on my record. I wish I could master that.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they do. But it's just interesting the way obviously Stanley Clark, kind of fantastic virtuoso player. But if when people try and copy it, I don't know, it's almost like know your place, bass player.
Yes.
I grew up listening to, you know, my teens listening to kind of very awkward kind of John Peel type bands where you would never hear that noise. And it's interesting how you come to dislike the tone or the actual sound of the music just because of the music it's associated with rather than the music itself. Do you know what I mean?
Well, something like Stanley Clark sounds too sophisticated, a bit glib to some people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would have sneered at that probably when I was 16, horrible little oik that I was.
Right.
But now I've grown to appreciate it. It's like sax solos. You know, I would have hated sax solos when I was a teenager.
I think you've got an example of sax solos, have we? I think there was the one here. Oh, yes, of course. Baker Street. Is that Raff Ravenscroft, he's called, the guy playing the saxophone, I think, on there? I think he is.
I think saxophones were barely mentionable at all, but really in the kind of, as I was growing up, just awful, awful instruments. And now I love them, you know. I don't know. I've been listening to lots of Ashford and Simpson and lots of stuff like that, and I love them.
I suppose saxophone is an instrument that you can't kind of, you can't busk your way on, can you? You know, whereas you can pick up a guitar and you can play three chords.
Yeah.
Whereas a saxophone takes a bit of mastering. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. And conversely, you know, guitar feedback, which is something I probably found exhilarating many years ago, now I find... Would you please stop making that infernal dip?
that's kind of adolescent fixation, is it? Getting feedback. What's this from?
This is the beginning of Anthrax by Gang of Four. I do still really love this. It's probably not the best example. But there is that sense that something exciting is about to happen. You know?
Yes. Yeah. No, I can hear that, definitely. I wish it would happen. Of course, some of these are also, they start off as mistakes, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I can't think of any particular examples that started off as mistakes.
Well, I'm going to throw one in. The first case I know of something that started as a mistake, according to the story that's told, is that Ike Turner's Kings of Rhythm were on their way to a recording date at Sam Phillips Studio in Memphis in, I don't know, 1955. And they had a guitar player called Willie Kizart. And they had all their instruments and equipment on the top of the car that they were making their way down Highway 61 in. And these came loose, and Willie Kizart's amp fell off and bust the speaker cone. And so when they got to the recording date, it sounded odd, the guitar tone, but Sam Phillips liked it, so they just recorded. And that's Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenston, which to many people is regarded as the first ever rock and roll record, is characterised by a mistake, by something actually being broken, contributing to the sound.
I think anyone who's ever spent any time in a recording studio will be aware of just how mind-numbingly tedious the whole process is of putting music together in that way. And I think, noises spring up from nowhere, and you're so relieved that you're hearing something that you haven't already heard 50 times in a row. Think, oh my goodness, yes, we'll have that. And so a lot of that goes on in studios. I mean, I remember bands I used to be in. We used to record in this studio just under a railway arch in Brixton, just off Cold Harbour Lane. And the there was this noise, this electrical noise that kind of sounded throughout. You could constantly hear it, and you became massively irritated by this thing. But then you thought, you know what? We'll have to try and incorporate this into the music itself. So we ended up kind of trying to turn it up and plastering it all over everything to make a feature of it rather than a bug.
The you talk about Phil Collins' gated drum sound,
yeah,
which I'm sure will be familiar to many people, because Phil Collins' records went so far. I don't know, Fraser, you can play that for us. We can imagine the sound of that's
something
perfect.
Like that.
That's better on his own. This is the thing that was we recently had the monkey playing the drums, didn't we, on some TV ad in the same style. How did that start? Did that start as a mistake, or does that start with somebody who just wants a sound that's absolutely huge and distinctive?
I don't know, actually, but I imagine it's one of those things where you know you've got drums running through loads of effects units. And then people are twiddling, and then suddenly, no, you had it a minute ago. Go back. Yeah, turn it back. Yes, that. And it's the difference between a drum hit, and then when it's extended in that way, so you go, it's just like a block of noise. And then if you put extra reverb on top of that, it just becomes something. Yeah, it's massive.
What difference has it made in studios nowadays? Because you don't just hear the sound; you can see the sound, can't you? Now, because of the way things are recorded,
yeah,
you're looking at it on a display. Has that made a difference, do you think?
Well, I mean, yes, in the sense that everything is infinitely editable and copyable and pastable and reversible. It's made all of those processes that would have taken weeks beforehand very, very easy to do. I'm not sure if that's a particularly good thing.
Right. Now, the second part of this feature, the first part very much what you might call natural sounds. And the second part, I suppose, is mainly stuff that's come along in the era of digital music, in the era of dance music, which has changed things massively. And lots of these effects that are now available at the push of a button, pretty much, were originally very, very laborious to make, weren't they? To actually get these sounds in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think sampling. When I wrote the piece, it kind of tails off. And I mean, obviously the quality remains very high throughout, absolutely. But in terms of the number of sounds, it tends to tail off more recently. And I think that's kind of because of sampling. I mean, sampling kills this idea in a way, because everything can be lifted and copied and repurposed. So it's less about sound creation than sound manipulation, I suppose.
Right.
But it's interesting though in the speed in which kind of newer noises can be devalued. I think one of the things we had in there was the orchestra hit, which is kind of, again,
like in Yes's owner of a Lonely Heart, I think was probably probably the example. Might be otherwise... That, at the
right
very
the beginning,
beginning,
yeah.
Otherwise known as a stab, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I first heard that on... I mean, Art of Noise Records, of course, they were involved in the making of that album as well. But I heard that on Art of Noise Records when I was 12 or 13. And I just found that to be... It had been an extraordinary noise. I mean, obviously, that was something to do with those Art of Noise Records, which I adored, and the way they were presented as these very futuristic, very strange objects. But then, 3 years later, that noise was all over every Stock Aitken Waterman record, yes. And it just became faintly repulsive. It just...
Is that by association, or just you'd heard it too much?
Yeah, you'd heard it too much. So it's one of Stock, Aitken, or Waterman decided that that was a good thing to put at the end of a verse or a chorus and use it. I mean, I was listening to some old Squitty Politti stuff recently with a view to we're doing some concerts and trying to find, you know, some old songs to do. And I found, yeah, suddenly in the middle of Provision, which is 1988, I think, suddenly there's this orchestra stab, and it was, oh no, what an awful thing to hear in the middle of all that.
So, how do you feel? We had Thomas Dolby in on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I was asking him about the kind of 80s sound, which now has a very bad reputation. You know, that people associate the 80s with a very kind of tinny drum sound and very thin and, you know, a lot of tinkly keyboards and so forth. Do you share that view? Or do you look at that with... Do you hear that with affection?
I love tinkly keyboards now.
Right.
I don't know why that is. Again, I would have, yeah, gone through a period where I loathed them, but I think one of them is in here as well, the DX7. Electric piano sound, which is described online as the most yeah, there's a forum and it says DX7 electric piano, the most irritating noise ever.
Oh, well, let's hear that. Have we got the most irritating noise ever?
Sure.
Do we know what the example of it was? So that's Chicago. So that's what the...
That's why the...
Yeah, it's the vocal that comes out. So that's what some musicians regard as the, you know, just an evil sound, that kind of thing, because we heard it too much.
Yeah, but again, it's to do with it being heard too much. And at the time, everyone was like, "That's fantastic! That sounds fantastic!" So everyone used it, and then everyone...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You mentioned that Brian Eno in this piece, that Brian Eno described "I Feel Love," the Donna Summer breakthrough hit, as being... I think the record that changed absolutely everything. There was some quote similar. That took a lot of putting together, that sound, didn't it, originally?
Yeah, because the technology... I mean, today, that would just be so easy to do. You just feed the noise into a sequencer and just... You make 16 little dots in the matrix on your sequencer and off it goes.
Whereas that, when they did it in, what, the mid-70s, I suppose?
Yeah, mid to late 70s.
How would they have done that then?
An immense amount of studio trickery. I can't remember the guy's name who was the studio assistant that day.
Right.
But he'd worked out a way of doing this that Moog hadn't. You know, they hadn't worked it out either. This way of syncing the synthesizer to the tape and letting it run and making that incredible sound. Very laborious, and as you say, changed dance music.
Because the other example from around about the same time, and I don't know if this is on your list, it's probably not, is Night Fever, any of those records that the Bee Gees made that went on Saturday Night Fever. They made those with the traditional rhythm section, and then just looped everything. They just apparently they were listening back to it, and one of the Gibbs said, "No, I like the way it just sounds. I want it to be as repetitious as possible." And so they did this by just looping tape, didn't they?
Yeah, and it's interesting now, of course, looping is part and parcel of making music with computers. It's just like you get a section and you just paste it.
A computer
paste
is
it,
a loop
it.
Machine, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
Really? It just repeats things.
And of course, what you're doing now with computers is battling with the computers to try and get back to a more humanized version. And you know, you'll see in menus on computer sequences, humanize.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, actually, that
word.
Instruction.
Yeah.
Humanize.
Yeah, in order to kind of just shift the notes backwards or forwards slightly, or the velocity in which they're hit. We yearn for those pre-Bee Gees days.
It's a serious syndrome, isn't it, that? Because I was intrigued by this when I was doing a piece a while ago about the decline of recording studios, and I discovered that nearly all these classic recording studios, Muscle Shoals or, you know, Gold Star in Hollywood or whatever, they've lent their names to bits of software that you can bring into your Pro Tools that will supposedly give your recording the sound of Studio A at Motown in 1965 or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's various bits of software, reverb modelling software, where they... I don't even know how they do it, but I think they make
They go into the room, apparently, and record silence. God knows how that works.
Yeah.
This is selling fresh air, this really is, isn't it?
I think they probably, yeah, they record the response to probably a very short noise. And we're able to digitally emulate that in our bedrooms. Thank goodness. No more going to sing in the bathroom in order to kind of get that slight slight reverby noise.
We were also talking in a recent podcast to musician David Ford, who was saying that... that there's a great correlation between the kind of the way records are made on Pro Tools nowadays and the kind of records that radio stations will play nowadays. And so the music you hear on the radio is quite a narrow spectrum of sound, and that's what radio is used to nowadays. And they don't like anything that gets outside that spectrum. Do you think there's anything in that?
Yeah, I think there probably is. And, of course, with that comes the whole question of the mastering thing, which you hear a lot about these days, the way that records are becoming louder and louder, and this block of noise that we're very used to hearing. And if you get a CD that isn't as loud as the last CD that you've...
It's a disappointment.
You think that it's somehow malfunctioning.
Right. Now, we've obviously, since the piece was in the magazine and on the website with all the samples, and that's obviously available for people to listen to if they want to, we've had loads of suggestions of noises that aren't in there and that maybe should be. And I'm just going to try and get this... I have to say, this is my suggestion... And if anybody can think of a name for this, I'd be very, very grateful. This is the bit that you hear at just about the beginning of just about every ska record. Just that drum sound.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If you go back to the Scatterlights or whatever, you'll hear that on just about every one of the records. Here it is again. It's delightful, isn't it?
It is.
I'd like that to be my ringtone, actually.
I don't know what that's called. I mean, it's boom biggity boom or something.
It's the guy who... He died recently, the drummer. He was in his 80s. He's still playing, and I've now sadly forgotten his name.
Scar has the number of those unnameable noises. We were talking earlier about the chick, 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 chick.
Which is one of the most ubiquitous noises in popular music, isn't it? But nobody's given it a name at all. Now, that is done by somebody... at a microphone, making that noise just as you've done it.
Yeah.
It must be.
Yeah, there's no. It's a very precise percussive sound. You wouldn't be able to match that shaking an egg, as people... an egg with beans in, as people do in studios. So, yeah.
This, and I don't know if this is an example, but somebody suggested this drop D tuning. Is that an example?
That's
Nirvana.
I'm hearing a D there. At the bottom.
But, why is it called drop D tuning?
On a guitar, the bottom three strings are tuned E, A and D, usually. And if you drop the E to a D, you get D, A and D, which is basically the power chord, which is also mentioned in the piece. The Kinks, you really got me.
Right. That one.
which is not an example of drop D tuning, but it just but by dropping the D, it becomes easier to play. You just put your finger across the whole three frets, so it becomes easier to play.
Another suggestion, I don't know if this is a perfect example, is the Vox Continental organ sound. Is that it?
I wouldn't know, tragically.
That's how I'm showing my age. That is the Stranglers covering Question Mark and Mysterion's 96 Tears, which I always thought was an example of the Vox Continental sound. If anybody knows better, they can get in touch. So that's another one of your kind of piano substitutes.
I saw some kind of blistering criticism online for things that weren't included. But, I mean, it's difficult to approach this subject without... without putting your own likes into it, do you know what I mean? I mean, somebody was furious that there was no Led Zeppelin mentioned throughout the whole...
Just as a general point, people get so indignant about this sort of stuff. You know, as if you say, we've scientifically tested the 40, most important noises in popular music.
There are no other possible answers.
No, absolutely.
There was one, I mentioned within the palm-muted guitar, where you just mute the bottom of the... strings with your hand, and I used an example, Billy Bragg, which to me growing up was a
big thing.
A very familiar manifestation of that sound, and of course just get these sarcastic comments online saying, yes, of course Billy Bragg is the best example of that sound. And of course, you know, if you're immersed in the world of black metal, Billy Bragg is not the best example of that, and they'll be furious that you haven't citated Hellhammer or something.
It's just a general point about the web, isn't it, Fraser? People reach for indignation straight away, don't they?
Yes, that's the default setting.
The default setting is indignation. I'm sure they don't mean to sound as indignant as they come over.
No, they don't.
Do you think? We're going to try and do another part of this.
Yeah.
We've done two parts so far, but we've had loads of other suggestions. Is there anything you kicked yourself that you missed that you'd like to put in the third part?
I'm a bassoon player. Part of me wants to shoehorn the bassoon in there, but there's just not enough examples. The examples of bassoon in rock are very few and far between.
Can you tell me one?
Well, I think it appears in Puppet on a String.
Right.
And I think it's in...
It's probably in loads of European...
Tears of a Clown as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm sure it's in there. Also, there's a bassoon solo in Outdoor Minor by Wire.
Just Wire. What about the Motown tambourine?
Motown tambourine, I thought was a really good point somebody made.
Tambourine was definitely... I think tambourine might have not made the cut originally.
Which you probably should have done, actually.
Yeah.
Because if you go and listen to all those classic mid-60s Motown records, they all got it on there. They had one tambourine player, didn't they, in the great band, the guy who just played the tambourine. And you can hear him at the beginning of Heard It Through the Grapevine, can't you?
Yes.
He rattles the tambourine at the very beginning of that. And it is extraordinary that sound... worked for them on pop radio so well, because it made everything cut through, didn't it? It made the rhythm cut through.
Yeah.
But it also had that churchy, gospel, the church ladies on Sunday thing about it, which was the kind of the basis of Motown, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it was the kind of the ghetto bit of Motown, and also the bit that appealed on pop radio in Britain. Extraordinary thing.
And another suggestion I really liked was the count-off. The one, two, three, four beginning of Cheers, which is obviously not an integral part of the song itself, but everything from I Saw Her Standing There, The Beatles begins with a 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's more than that, isn't it? It goes 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah,
it's percussive, isn't it?
That first
is there that Paul McCartney does that? Sorry,
that's with the Ramones, obviously.
Yeah,
the Ramones. It almost turned into a joke, wasn't it? Because they had that at the beginning of every. Every tune. And he never seemed to bear any relation to the speed at which they played it. They just said 1, 2, 3, 4 as fast as they possibly could.
And then you got, I remember, S Express. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes.
As well. So lots of different manifestations.
And that, you see, comes from Sam and the Sham and the Pharaohs, Woolly Bully, I thought. Oh,
thanks for telling me. Showing my own ignorance.
I'm sure they got it from somebody long before. I had a half an idea that there might be something in silences in records. that there are lots of silences in you know, well-known records, little pauses.
Not just between the tracks, you mean?
Here. No, I'm talking about within, and I can't immediately think of one, but they're all slightly different. There must be slightly different lengths, and obviously they're governed by what came before them and what came after them.
We're back to recording silences again.
Right. Yeah. So you're going to have a go at doing part three.
Yeah.
Which we'll look forward to seeing. And if anybody's got any suggestions, you know, post them on the website, wordmagazine.co.uk.
The Word Podcast. It passes the time.
Roderick, you've had a bit of an internet hit recently, haven't you, with an idea you had. No, don't be modest. I'm very impressed by this. You started a thing on Twitter... Yes, called First Date Disasters, yes?
First Date Hell.
Okay, start. Yeah. Tell us the story from the beginning.
I'd be loath to call this an idea, I have to say, because it wasn't an idea, it just sprung from... I was on a very long walk home. It was my own choice to go on the long walk, incidentally. I walked past a pub in Clapham South, where about 9 years ago I'd been on an excruciating date. My only memory of this pub was sitting in this pub with this girl just being unable to think of anything to say. Rather like me today at the Word Podcast.
No.
Not at all. And I just tweeted about it. And
what did you say in your first tweet? Can you remember?
It was a lot. I mean, I remember the girl was from Wigan. And I just remember, just in the depths of not knowing what to say to her, saying, "So, Wigan, what's it like then?" And I think if you utter those words during a date, you should probably go home. But because we were too British and polite to say, "This date's dreadful, I'm going home," we stuck it out for 3 hours saying things like that. Obviously, what I've just said there does not fit into 140 characters, point was, Wigan, what's it like? And I had lots of replies. Thousands of replies from people.
So you started a hashtag?
I didn't start a hashtag, crucially. People would just post them back to me, and then I reposted them. And thus maintaining complete control of the project. Very neat, accidental idea there. So I
started... What are the examples of some of the ones that people came back with?
The first one that just made me laugh out loud and think, oh, these are going to be really good. Was someone who's a girl who said he took me out to the pub car park to show me his motorbike, revved it for 10 minutes, did a lap, then drove off. and the thing is, when you go on these dates, there's so much riding on them. You're so hopeful, and so every story has its you know, enormous poignancy. And there's, you know, there's just so many examples of fantastic. Things mainly to do with man's inhumanity to woman. I mean, 85-90% of the stories were from women.
This is what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, it's either because men are just less forthcoming about their own horrific experiences, or just we're more badly behaved, and I tend to think it's probably the latter. I mean, there are lots of examples of bad excuses to get out of dates. The one guy said he had to go home because there was a chicken breast going off in his fridge.
So we were talking about this in the office when this was, you know, first starting to go mad on Twitter, and the thing that makes it work is that it's first date hell or first date disasters.
Mm.
Because you could have things equally going wrong on the third date or whatever.
Yeah.
But what makes it work is the idea that it's the first date, isn't
yeah.
it? That was the beginning and that was the end.
Yeah, and the other thing is that there were just loads more of these stories around these days, just because of the past 10 years internet dating becoming a thing. And what that's introduced to dating is this idea that you will spend an evening in a room with someone you've never met before, you know virtually nothing about, because a computer says that you're compatible, which is a pretty crazy...
I read some stat the other day, which I find difficult to believe, that 65% of people nowadays meet their partner via internet dating. Can that be true?
That wouldn't surprise me. I think
that's extraordinary.
I think it's as true as the same percentage meeting in a dance hall in the 1930s. It's the way people meet.
Yeah, it's the way we socialise. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be via a specific dating website, but, you know, I'm sure love has blossomed on the Word forums, no?
Yes, it has. Oh, yes, we know about it as well, don't we?
I can think of two examples.
But it's happening on Facebook, presumably, all the time. So this is completely replaced the way that my generation used to pair off, which was somebody like me taking the long walk across the dance floor to the other side, the echoing of my footsteps, to go to Angela Noble.
Oh, Angela.
And ask her if she wanted to dance. Ugh. And then she would say, no thanks. And then I'd go back to the dance floor.
I just don't know whether I can go on.
it's a serious point, you know, that for hundreds of years, we were talking about this in the office again the other day, hundreds of years kind of pairing off was happened around dancing, didn't it?
And drink.
Well, even before drink, you know, in the days of Jane Austen, you know, people weren't three sheets of the wind in the 19th century. They had a dance card. They knew exactly who they were going to dance with, you know, and that would immeasurably add to their excitement, their anticipation of the evening. And that's gone. That's replaced with Facebook going, you know, do you fancy going for a drink? Yeah?
Well, you know, I'm sure there are more romantic ways of approaching people online, I'm sure.
All right.
I'm sure there are. I found two music-related dating stories that I brought with us, just in order to tie it in.
Go on.
I thought, one girl complained she went on a date with a guy in a covers band, and she asked him if he wrote his own material, and he said, no, there's enough music out there already. Which is quite nice. And a man took a girl to the pub on the premise that they have good music. There and they arrived, and there was a mass ukulele practice. and I have to say, the ukulele's become that will not be featuring. I have to say, in the next 40 noises.
You don't thing. Like?
No, it's become something. I can no longer bear it. I mean, I know people who play. In fact, a friend of mine just took her grade one ukulele exam. she's about 32 years old, and she was taking her exam with a load of 6-year-olds.
Well, he's going into school now instead of the recorder.
Yeah, I suppose.
Is he really?
Yeah.
It's a more pleasant noise than the recorder, isn't
undoubtedly.
It?
And more useful in real life.
Yeah, in what way?
You take it with you on holiday.
And it's, and what annoyed people
you'd accompany.
With it?
You'd accompany yourself.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, no one would bemoan the death of the descant recorder at all. But I suppose, yeah. I think it's just become a bit twee and kooky.
Right.
But you know. I can be convinced otherwise if a petition is drawn.
So your tweet hit has turned into a book.
Yeah, I'm yes.
So
currently,
this is how to get a book deal, kids.
I wouldn't recommend. I wouldn't recommend it. But yeah, I've currently got to put together a book about bad dating, which will involve some of my own poignant reflections and then a massive admin job asking people if I can use their tweets in a book. So.
Right, right. So it's interesting that it was a hit before you probably recognised that it was a hit, isn't it? You know, that's the thing that happens with the internet. Memes, is that what we call them?
Indeed, yeah.
That it's the market out there that tells you this is interesting.
Yeah.
Rather than you knowing yourself. You didn't tweet the first one going, yeah, this is going to take off. It's going to go like wildfire.
No, it happened late at night. I tend to tweet rather intensively late at night. And so I'd reposted a lot of these stories at night. And then in the morning I went to a meeting, emerged from the meeting, and I suddenly had like 3,000 more followers on Twitter. So, yeah, it was something of a surprise.
Very good.
Yeah.
But they can't get it out in time for Christmas.
They can't. I think it's going to be the perfect Valentine's Day gift for the singleton. For the singleton, you know, who needs a bit of reassurance that it's not just them who's having these horrific experiences.
So we're going to go around, we're finished with the first date disasters. We'll go around the table. I'll go first. When I took Angela Noble to the pictures, I didn't have enough money to pay for her. So I had to turn to her at the box office and say, I'm sorry, have you got some money? So it was not a good place to start at all. What about you, Fraser?
Never had a disaster.
Never had a first date.
No, I think that reflects more on my lack of dating than any skill I might otherwise possess.
No. So, Roderick, have you got one?
I've got loads. I've been loath to share them just in, because so many people have... I think 250,000 people have viewed the page with these tweets on. I've been concerned that if mine were on there, I would start getting... You know, someone would recognise themselves and expose me as just a terrible datee. But I do remember going on a date where the girl turned up. I was reading The Guardian, and the girl turned up and she went, "Oh, my God, you don't read that, do you?" Yeah, not a marriage made in heaven.
Newspapers best avoided, of all kinds, I'm sure. Roderick, thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent every month.